accession number 29431, Reel 3.
Mr. Dennis Haywood, Rule 3.
Not really. I mean, everything was sensitive insofar that it was vital communication from senior people in headquarters. But it was encoded when I was, that was when I was an operator. Later, of course, when I was on the technical maintenance side, all you were concerned with was keeping the apparatus working, really. As well as you could, and you know, improving it where you could, or, and helping the local technicians with the problems they had. But no, it was all pretty confidential stuff. I well remember one occasion when we were down in that sort of area, in 5th Army Headquarters area, and we were pulled over by military police, and it turned out that Field Marshal Alexander was coming along, and he passed, and in an open big Hummer car, I think it was, sitting in the back there, and returned our salute with just two outriders. So it was quite a thing to have seen him quite so close, actually, because normally you don't see senior people like that very often. But, you know, it is the Americans, we got on very well with them. Communications were, we were doing our own communications and they were doing their own, but where we needed to liaise on technical grounds, they were very helpful. Always.
How long were you based in Salerno?
Oh, not very long. In Naples some time, because I started to move with the American section I was with, and I was with them, I suppose, about 9 months together. And then I got a posting to Air Formation Signals, which meant I moved back to Naples. And we were then responsible for, of course, the communications and the bomber command and down at Foggia in those days, and various places around the Adriatic coast, and sometimes southern Italy, and sometimes back in Sicily. And it was rather more working down there. That's why I used this mobile workshop rather than the stuff being brought to us. We used to go to them so that they could bring their apparatus into us for checking over and repair and replacement as needed. I did have one very fortunate pickup, if you like, from the point of view of the Italian arsenal at Naples. Through the liaison with various people down there, I managed to get free access to apparatus that I wanted from the arsenal, and I was able to get sheets of aluminium, for example, which we could use in making up some of the equipment ourselves. I managed to get mercury vapor rectifiers for battery charging, which are very useful, because you could then use the mains where the mains were working, and that was a bit iffy because we wanted three phase so mains, and what we used to do is just climb up and clip off. When you think about it, probably put all the local voltages down, but the section I was with, I devised a special bell apparatus which rang when the mains failed so that they could start up the generator. And then it rang again by throwing a switch when the mains came on so that they could turn that off and put that on. I think it used to send the electricians a bit up the wall, but it was quite useful to be able to use this big mercury vapour rectifier to charge the batteries, because of the noise of the big generator we otherwise had to use. So that was quite worthwhile. And also to get the apparatus, I mean, you'll get valves, or radio valves and things. I managed to requisition from there. And one of the things, as I was very keen on motorbikes in those days, and everyone seemed to be requisitioning things, and so I thought, well, I'll have a go at that. And I requisitioned a broken down motor gussy which had been used by the Naples civil defence people. It was in their headquarters, and I think it was minus tyres or something like that, or something was wrong with the engine. It was a sort of motor gussy engine, a motorbike with a box construction at the back, like a small pickup truck. And I used to ride that around when I had to go off to his places in Naples quite often. And I think when I subsequently met some of my people years later, they said they never felt more frightened in their life than when I used to invite them to come and join me when I was going somewhere. They used to sit on this little box construction with a wooden arm coming down the side beside me on the front of this box, but they very bravely came. In the end, on the move I ran out of tyres on that, and I had to abandon it, and it actually turned out to be standby. They used the engine for standby generator for power themselves.
Had you ridden a motorbike before you went to Africa?
No, I learned in on a course in the army, which I very much enjoyed, actually. I drive most of the vehicles we had. I mean, the favourite was a Jeep, if you could get hold of a Jeep. But we had... there was an establishment with the technical section. We had one motorbike. We had a large lorry and a small lorry and a pickup truck. I think that was about our sort of, if you like, establishment. And I used to do my best to get hold of the motorbike when I could. And I mean, I once rode it back all the way from southern Italy back to Naples, up over the mountain roads, with my mobile workshop, and had a great fright when I saw that their tyres had burnt out, and the tyres were on fire, and fortunately the driver managed to pull it up. But you know, the things were a little bit iffy on some of the brakes in those days on big hills.
How did things stand in Naples at that time regarding food and so forth?
Well, with the civil population, they were in a pretty hard way when we got into Naples. There's a lot of very old buildings. The southern Italy, they go in for very tall blocks, which are very good, they keep the sun out, but they're a bit compacted. Salerno is the same. And they were short of water. The army had water trucks. You could see the army water trucks running around, helping them with water supply. And one of the awful things was, of course, that the Germans, you know, left notices up. They wrote things on the walls: "We shall be back." And the awful thing were the booby traps. So, like coloured toys. And a number of children, of course, were injured with those. I had a bit of a fit one day when I came into my workshop one evening, and one of my mechanics was dismantling one. I had to get that stopped, of course, but you know, these chaps are very keen to find out how things work. But
what did they look like?
Well, like a sort of light, a bright coloured toy, and sort of thing a child or a person would pick up from the curiosity point of view. But of course, if it went off, it was dire consequences. That was nasty. And of course, the Germans did blow up an initial Roman aqueduct, which had been supply of water to part of Naples since Roman times. That was damaged deliberately by the Germans. But that's part of the problem there at the time. The Germans were very angry, with the Italians changing sides. There was a concern about what was happening with the Italian Navy, because it was a big Italian Navy base at Taranto. And I think a very senior commander, I don't know if it was the commander-in-chief of the Italian Navy, but one of their battleships was sunk on its way to surrender in Malta. And it was before the landing could be secured, and the landing at Salerno and other places, it was the first one in mainland Europe. But this landing in Sicily, of course, had been earlier, but it was the first mainline landing, main European landing in southern Europe. Since the Second World War, there were other incidental ones made by the Dieppe and things like that, but that was the first big one, and so that was really the importance of it. It was difficult to know what the political situation was going to be, because Mussolini really held things down. I mean, one of the headquarters we had, our section in, had been a sort of fascist headquarters, and all the paperwork was there. And I think the intelligence people weren't very pleased with us when we got it all out into the garden, and the local people were coming along and tearing at it. But it was a question of setting up the workshop properly, and that was where the workshop was going to be, and I'm afraid I gave that priority. But the intelligence people caught on with it afterwards when we were being crossed. You know, you have to make these quick decisions.
Did you have any options?
Well, you couldn't work without space, and where you can set your stuff up. I mean, you know, if everything's packed up, you can't open up apparatus and take it apart, which is what our job entailed. You know, taking it all apart and repairing it and things, we just couldn't do it.
So were you intense?
No, we were in factories and warehouses and things like that. Well, mostly, and sometimes in large houses, which were requisitioned. That wasn't too bad. But, except when you were burning the field anywhere, you stick to the back of the truck or whatever.
During the time that you were overseas, were you in touch with your family?
Oh, yes. I used to write home. But it's a very difficult situation, because you couldn't... You're a bit inhibited because of censorship, and you're a bit inhibited because of the need for security. I mean, I remember even back in the UK getting a lift. I mean, it was very confusing. Just before I got my posting overseas, my unit had moved. I got posted, you know, the papers to go and warrants to go to a unit, and found it had moved. And I got a lift with an American officer, and he was pamping me where I was going and what it was all about. And I had to say even to him, "No, I'm awfully sorry. No, I always. I really don't know. You had to really keep. I mean, what if I chatted away? You probably said, "Well, look, you've been telling me too much," and pulled me up for that as well. So you know, you had to. And so the same thing applied with your letters. Really, you could write the usual routine stuff, what you were doing, but guarded where you were.
But your own letters were still edited, were they?
The officers would just look through them, initial them, and sign them. I don't think they read them very often. But they had to sign them.
And you received post? Oh, you would just say.
Yes, the post came actually. There wasn't an awful lot because it was in the army. Our post came in the form of special folding cards, which our families wrote and posted to us, and they were opened, microfilmed, and the microfilm was sent out by air. In fact, it was one of those planes that I went on, sending the mail out to North Africa and then on. They were then reconstituted, and so you really got a photographic reproduction of the original letter when you were overseas. I don't know whether it happened in reverse. They probably just sent the things complete. But coming that way, it was a question of the speed and convenience and quickness that they could do it that way. So, I mean, when you think of all the forces involved, you could get all that post in a couple of sacks, for example, by doing it in microfilms. Whereas otherwise, it would be room for it stuff. You couldn't really cart it about. But that was one of the things that did happen in the field. You had a post office service, army post office service. They were very, very good. I mean, because letters from home were very important.
Parcels as well?
And parcels, yes, that's right.
What sort of things would you have received?
Well, the best thing, the most important thing I wanted was to keep up to date with the old Wireless World magazine and things like that. But I never asked for food or supplies and things because you knew that food was short at home. So I didn't think that would be fair. And we weren't too badly off, really, for food ourselves and forces. In fact, at one stage, we were sending things home at the end of hostilities. I remember sending home, somehow we could buy things to the Nafi. And one of them was a big box of fat, which of course was in very short supply, cooking fat. And I sent my mother one of those, I think. Which I think she was pleased to receive at the time, because everything like that was very rationed. But I mean, you know, sending anything else was very difficult because obviously you got well shaken up by the time we got there, and possibly delayed and heated.
Did you get to meet any of the locals?
Yes. Quite often you were friendly, you got asked out, and you went with small groups and had meals with people and things like that. It was difficult to get too involved because you didn't know how long you were going to be there and stationed you there. But some people did. I mean, when they were fixed in some places, they met local girls. In fact, a number of my section met and married Italian girls, and they had happy marriages. There was a bit of a gap between whether you had established families and you were, you know, you'd done all the social events, or there was a bit of a gap. And unfortunately, in my case, 17 was a bit of a gap. There was like. The bottom fell out of the routine world you were in and growing up in and developing in, you know, your office things and the office functions and the social events you were taking part in, because in signals you were posted to very remote spots in the UK by the very nature of where you were. I mean, they were in isolated remote spots in Nissenhaus and things like that.
So what would you have done with leisure time?
Oh, well, pictures and dances and things like that, really. But and leave. you had a period of leave, you had a week's leave, and I used to, of course, go home. But home was not quite the same, because my home, parents' home in Wandsworth was Bolton. My mother was looking after the two daughters of a friend of hers, who was married to a mining engineer, and who got a job in Africa just before the war. So she had these two, and looked after them. And she took part in sort of the evacuation, you know, following on business with the children and with the gas mask. She volunteered as a mother to go with the evacuation to back up the teachers. She went around the country in various places. And then to various relatives. We had a relative, she had a great aunt down at Chepstow, she went and stayed there. I remember going on, visiting her on a leave there, down at Crampy at one stage. She was with the school when she first evacuated. And then when London was bombed again, and it was pretty badly bombed, I mean, crossing London to go on leave, you know, you had to sort of take cover sometimes, at least for the underground, that sort of thing. And crossing London at night, which hasn't as really come down for Newmarket to get down, she was down in Hampshire.
But did she come home to find the house, the home bombed?
No, the house was bombed after she was evacuated with the school. And I was over at Putney, and there was a woman and two little girls killed just round the corner. And I was only, about 18, I suppose, just about 18. And my father wouldn't let me go there, but he helped get them out, the remains. And the house was damaged, but not destroyed, and was subsequently repaired after the war. And you know, we moved back for a few years, and that was it.
So you were able to live at home for a while after the war, were you?
Oh yes, I lived there. Yes, married in 51, I think. Yes, back in 46.
But you finished your service in Egypt, is that right?
And in Palestine, actually. Yes, yes, I got posted to with air formation signals to a unit in the canal zone, well actually in what is called the Great Bitter Lakes. It was a big maintenance unit down there. And I often think about that sort of posting from there. I got a posting from there to go to Palestine command signals. And because it was a question, you know, there'd been the mandate after the First World War. And I got a posting by train, crossing Sinai by train at night, Sinai Desert. And I often thought of my father, who served under Allenby in the First World War, and I think went across the Sinai Desert on foot, and who had done guard duty, I think, then of course there's the Allenby Bridge there, outside the Church of the Nativity, which I went to look at. Right. Well, that was it, really. The signals apparatus was the usual thing. They set up with a maintenance section doing the usual things there. I managed to do a little bit of visiting. I had a friend who was a even Reiki motorcyclist, and we went on a motorbike down to the Dead Sea just for a visit. I flew once across the Sinai Desert when I was still with air formation signals. But at the end, because the situation was getting a bit tricky, well, from the international point of view, and there was the Stern gang there, who were in fact, I suppose, an active terrorist really in those days. It was very tricky, and I was actually deferred. I've got a letter somewhere, I've still got a type of letter saying I was deferred as operationally vital, because I think we were about to be moved to Cyprus. But I pleaded that I'd been a long time in, and served nearly 7 years, and wanted to get back to my civilian career, and eventually got home.
How did you hear about the end of the war? How did you receive the news?
That's the workshop section. We had I managed to get hold of an old communications receiver which you needed to repair, and we repaired it. And we had that set up in the workshop for our own use, of course. And I had it also a link, so that I could actually, the bulletins used to come through, and every time there was a bulletin coming through, we used to pass the telephone, put the output from the radio on the telephone line to our headquarters, so that the adjutant and the colonel could in fact hear the latest news. And bulletins were published, and of course we had a map. We had a local forces newspaper which showed us, and inevitably showed maps showing the state of events. But at one stage, well before the end of hostilities, we were more worried about our families at home, and people at home were being bombed, houses destroyed, and even killed. Worried about them than they were about us, because it was pretty serious with some of these rocket things coming in, B1s and B2s and that sort of thing. Very frightening. No warning at all. But fortunately, it all came to an end.
So, did you have any celebrations?
Oh yes, yes. I locally with the unit, of course, we had celebration parties. You talked earlier about the locals. Well, we had a bit of talent in the unit, and I think we put on concerts occasionally, and the locals were invited in, because we operated, we occupied the, what would virtually be, I suppose, the town hall, with a big horn there, and it was Christmas time and things like that, we asked them in. It was after the end of hostilities, of course. But then, all at once, of course, we got posted to various places and ended up down in southern Italy again, and joined a unit who'd been lying semi-dormant for a long time, waiting in case they were needed to go across the Adriatic in via Yugoslavia. Their apparatus was all in a pretty bad state, but we sorted all that out. And I got a leave home for, I think, 4 weeks. Unfortunately, back just before Christmas of 1945. And then posted by sea to Egypt, Alexander, and Canal Zone. But I did at the end, just immediately after hostilities in Italy, did have a leave in Rome, which was very memorable, because it was new to the locals there to see English troops Rome in large numbers, and I managed to get into the opera. I was quite keen on the opera, and saw a very famous tenor, Gili, performing in La Force del Destino, which was quite an experience, because if you're sitting in an Italian audience, it's quite an experience. They know every line, every note, every word, and get very excited about all the big climaxes and climax feeling. It's very atmospheric. So that was an experience I'd always remember.